This is the Day Zero update for June 28th, 2015. I'm Philippe
Ogenofo. I'm Patrick Mifflin.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And over the next coming weeks, as news slows down, we'll probably be shifting a little more towards just talking about random stuff that catches our interest. But for today, we do seem to have a few good stories to talk about. So before we get to that, let's talk about what we're playing. Pat, you're up.
I'm back on Project Cars because before E3 started, Danrib and I talked about getting a review in for the site. And so I'm following up on that. I also picked up the early access version of Eastside Hockey Manager. That game's a lot to digest compared to the management options I'm used to from EA NHL. But once I start to get a handle on it, I think I'm really going to get into it. So
yeah, we'll see how that goes. Pretty much as deep as it gets as far as hockey management
it
goes.
It really is. I mean, it hasn't really asked me to set the pizza and beer prices at Pepsi Center yet, but I'm still waiting for it. But yeah, it really lets you get hands on with the rosters and everything. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and you've also been playing something you can't talk about. So.
Yeah, I'm under embargo.
Yeah,
it's a big embargo. But
we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, well, this is a game I will be discussing quite a bit once I'm no longer under embargo. I definitely had to just mention that here because it is taking up a lot of my gaming time.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, I've been going back to Forza 5 because, well, 6 is coming out soon, so I figured, you know, get back into the mood, you know?
Yeah.
Level up my my Drivatar a little bit so he's not crashing into everybody in Forza 6. That, you know, and that game is still good. There's since they launched it and they've been adding content to it steadily, so you know, it doesn't feel as bare bones as it once did.
It's true.
So that's pretty good. And yeah, I mentioned on Let's Weekend I was playing King Oddball, which is weird. It's like you're the man in the moon guy and you're flinging rocks at tanks and helicopters with your tongue, and I'm pretty sure some sort of drugs were involved in the creation of this game.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, it's you know, it's one of those one button type games. You know, line up your shot, hit the button, let it go. It's good for a few minutes of fun here and there.
Nice.
Yeah, it's also on absolutely every platform I could possibly think of, and a few.
No, it's one of those.
Yeah, you get it for BlackBerry if you actually have a BlackBerry. Yeah, so there's that. How about you, Lee?
So I was playing Witcher, and I stopped. Just kind of, I still really like that game. I do have an issue with the controls. For someone who, there's no weight to them. Like, Geralt's supposed to be like this superior, like badass. Like, I'll run up and wreck you and your whole family. Mm-hmm. And but yet he feels floaty. Like, extremely floaty.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like really kind of put a hurt on how much I enjoy the game. Still really fun. There's still plenty to do, but I kind of it's really interesting. I'm in this like weird shift because I was like, I don't really feel like I want to play this game because it's almost overwhelming in a way. Like, oh, if I pass by this thing, then I want to get these ingredients and this alchemy and this and this and what about this side quest and him going here and going there, and I've been so busy with work, I just want to be able to kind of like relax and get into something and just have that be like fun rather than feeling like I have a chores list, which is really ironic because that's actually – I pretty much have slowed down on playing WoW because they – a couple of weeks back, I think I talked about this a bit on the show, but Blizzard came out and said that they would not have flying in the game anymore, period. And the community basically threw a gigantic fit and was like, this is not cool. Like, we've always had flying in the game since the very first expansion. You know, why are you doing this? Blah, 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 blah. And Blizzard had this Q&A, like they had pushed it back. I hadn't seen their community in like an uproar like this since Diablo 3. Like, they they bunted when they first came out with that one. Yeah. And what was interesting about it is that basically, like, they came back, like, at this Q&A, they acknowledged that pretty much the expansion had been relatively lackluster except for Raids, the Warlords of Draenor expansion, which I think is actually a really fair assessment. That game is not – the expansion itself is not very good. It's just – that's the lightest content expansion they've ever had. And, you know, if you want to read more about it, it's certainly something you can look at, because it's a fascinating way to look at the way that some of these customers are dealing – or the way that some of these companies are dealing with their customers. But the funny part about this whole thing was that they said one specific thing during the during the Q&A, where they said that they were really disappointed, or they didn't really like what they did with, like, the reputation grinds in the game. Like, every MMO has some kind of grind where you get reputation for some kind of faction so you can get things from that faction. And whether it's, like, a mount or, like, armor, stuff for your crafting abilities, whatever the case may be, typically these types of grinds involve doing daily quests or going out and killing mobs and stuff like that. And Blizzard's rep grinds over the years had gotten kind of more and more interesting. Even if they were just stuff like going out and doing dailies or any of those types of things, they're still relatively interesting to do. But they had so many dailies in the Mists of Pandaria expansion, and a lot of people were like, hey man, this is too many dailies. So Blizzard being Blizzard, instead of actually taking the feedback and going, okay, well, we'll cut back on the dailies a little bit, we know people like these, but we're not going to go overboard, instead they pretty much took them out. And what they replaced them with are these things where you go into these zones, right, and a little progress bar pops up in the right-hand corner. And basically, you just kind of have to freeform kill things in these zones for like 20 minutes, right? Probably I'd say 90% of the people playing the game did not do those because they were boring and they were poorly designed. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, it was an excuse for all they had to do was they assigned some type of numeric value to each one of the mobs as a goal of a percentage, and that's the quest. So it's go out and kill however many things you need to kill to get this meter to hit 100, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound fun, and it's not fun. So they do this Q&A and they say, yeah, we think the reps and stuff were kind of really – they're poorly done and we didn't do them right. Well, they answered the issue with people wanting to fly in the game by creating this achievement called Draenor Pathfinder. Now, the funniest part about this whole thing is that for the longest time, people have been complaining that there's not enough to do in the actual expansion world, right? Mm-hmm. So this achievement to let you get flying, because the way you used to get flying is you hit max level, and once you hit max level, you just went to a vendor and you paid them, and you would pay some amount of gold, and that's what would let you fly, right? Well, now they locked it behind an achievement, and the achievement is basically, dude, it is one of the most passive-aggressive things I think I've ever seen a developer do, because it literally is – go do all these Apexis dailies that you guys have complained about that you told us aren't fun. Yeah, you're going to go do them anyway. We're going to make sure that you do every single quest so you get it's called the Loremaster achievement, where it's just basically you do all like the questing stuff for every area. And that part I actually don't have an issue with, because the questing from 90 to 100 in Warlords is fantastic. It's probably the best that they've ever done. But everything outside of that is terrible. And so now they're locking something that every player wants behind this basically what is a glorified chores list, where they don't have to actually address any of the bad designs that they used for this expansion, and they don't really have to create any new content. They're going to funnel people through this stuff anyway just to get them to do it, because they know enough people want flying that they'll go do this content that they weren't having fun with in the first place. Mm. And I'm in that, and I pretty much stopped playing because of it. Like, they added a new zone called Tanan Jungle, and this is right after they do the Q&A where they say, oh, yeah, we know the rep grinds are lame. They put the exact same rep grind on Tanan Jungle, and you have to do it for just about 30 days to get the reputation needed on top of all the other chores you have to do just to be able to fly. And I never thought that they would do something like that that seems so antagonistic to the players, but I literally just stopped playing. I'm not renewing my WoW account because I don't – I'm at the point in my life where I don't want games to feel like a chore, you know?
Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah, well, like it's just – it's crazy to me that they would do that. And I don't know what it is recently with companies like being really antagonistic towards their fan bases, but like Bungie did it earlier this past week during E3 with the stuff with the Fallen King, and where they basically said in order to get all the extra stuff with the expansion, you have to buy the game over and all the DLC in this one package that's $80.
Yeah.
And like they had their community manager guy being like, oh yeah, like, and like the exclusive stuff, if you get this version of the game, this $80 version of the game, are like three emotes, like three costume shaders, costume coloring shaders, and something else. And like there was a guy, I think it was from Eurogamer, who was talking to him, and the dude was just incredibly antagonistic. He was like, if you saw these shaders, man, you just throw money at me. You just throw money at me. And I'm just kind of,
wow.
Yeah. Like, and it's the same thing. Like here you have the designers from Blizzard talking about, we kind of really just produced this expansion that wasn't very fun outside of raiding. And, you know, we acknowledge all of the things that suck about it. And then they turn around in the next zone that they put out that's supposed to be like the Band-Aid and it's supposed to get people back into playing. It has the exact same gameplay elements that everyone rejected since the beginning of this expansion. I mean, they lost 3 million subscribers already. And I can't imagine that this is doing anything to garner them any goodwill. So I pretty much just cut all that stuff off. I never thought I'd say this. I actually went back to playing Star Wars with my wife. My wife started playing it again. And, you know, at least I expect EA and BioWare to just kind of be shitty. I don't expect that from somebody like Blizzard. But that it seems like that's kind of like their philosophy. I thought they learned from Diablo 3, where they basically, you know, upended the game and tried to fix everything. But it's almost like Blizzard's like, yeah, we know Warlords is just not good, and we're not going to do anything to fix it. We're just going to kind of wait until the next expansion. And I've never seen them do anything like that.
Wow.
So it really kind of has me like really kind of disappointed, because this is not something that I would expect from this company. And you know, they're doing more of that stuff like in Hearthstone. I don't know if you guys have read about that, but there's a set, like every character that you play, whether it's like a mage or a warrior or whatever, it has a corresponding character from the Warcraft universe that you're technically playing. And they released like 2 weeks ago, they released a new skin, like the warrior. That if you play a warrior in that game, you end up playing as Garrosh Hellscream, which was the main villain from Warlords, or not from Warlords of Draenor, but from Mists of Pandaria. Well, now they introduced this. Basically, it's kind of like what a skin pack is essentially for the game, where you can, the warrior changes from Garrosh to a dwarf named Muradin Bronzebeard. He's like the king of Ironforge, and the amount for him, is just to change this character, it's $10. It's basically a portrait that has a voice, and it's $10. So
Activision is like slowly infecting all of their studios with their arrogance.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And that was the thing. That was what I was thinking it all kind of came back to, because Bungie was never this way. Blizzard was never this way. And those actually are two companies, when you look at it, that are like really solely 100% focused on their client's experience. And that's the thing. Like, these are clients, right? Like, or customers, however, whatever you want to label them as. These are not people that are just kind of willing to, I guess, kind of get, I think, get screwed. And yet it seems like there's more and more contempt being shown for those customers, which – I don't know if you noticed, I'm segueing right into the very first thing that we're going to talk about, which leads to the whole thing with Arkham Knight. And I'm playing that on my PS4. It's fantastic. It avoids some of the pitfalls that I think City had. But the version that they put out for PC was so broken. and did not work properly at all, that WB actually suspended sales for that. Yeah. Now, I have a lot I could say on this, but I'm really curious what you guys think of this.
Well, first of all, I'd have to say that Steam refunds, I think, actually played a big part in this. Because now customers actually have a recourse, you know. And if WB starts seeing their numbers, sales numbers, like, suddenly drop, they're going to have to do something monetarily to, you know, just get their to stem the bleeding, basically. And the suspending sales is pretty much the only option they had. They couldn't have kept it on the store because that refund option was there. So it was really either suspend sales or just try to wait it out. And clients these days, they're getting a little bit more savvy than these big companies would like us to be. So, you know, that's my take on it. I think they're
well, yeah. And let me let me follow that up. Let me ask, and then we'll get on to Pat here, because I you know I got a lot to say. But so with that, so do you think that if the Steam refunds were not available, that they would have pulled this from the store?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because they've already made the sale.
Exactly. Okay.
I just have another case study in Mortal Kombat 10.
Yeah.
Where Steam refunds weren't there.
Yeah.
And it did release as a broken turd, and, you know.
Oh, the Mortal Kombat on PC was released broken as well?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
As was Shadow of War on PC. Oh, I didn't follow them. Arkham Origins. I don't think WB has had.
And another common thread here, I believe. A common thread here is I think they were both outsourced.
Yeah. Well, we know Arkham Knight was outsourced.
Yeah.
So
and I think
I didn't follow that. I had no idea that every one of their PC launches was borked.
Yeah.
So that leads into what I was going to say. And then, or actually, I'm sorry, Pat, go ahead. What do you think of all of this? Because I think it's absurd, but we'll get into that in a second.
I think, I just think it's a symptom of what happens when you outsource games to outside studios that aren't, or at least ports to studios that aren't as invested in them as the home studio. That's really, you know, it's something that we've talked about time and time again on the show, but now it seems to be something that WB's really falling into, and yeah, they've really got to get it sorted out, because, you know, if you're going to be on PC, be on PC. But, you know, don't just pass a port job off to a third-party studio that is always got, you know, a million different irons in the fire and has no special attachment to your game in particular compared to what you might have.
Do we know how much time that these studios that WB has basically farmed these ports out to? Do we know how much time they had to actually do these ports?
Well, I, for one, have no earthly idea.
Yeah, I have
the reason I'm asking. Oh, go ahead, Phil. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know how much time they had, but I can tell you they only allocated 12 people to the port.
See, that's crazy. This is, I think, arguably the Warner Brothers' biggest game this year. Right?
Right.
Like everything else, even as big as Mortal Kombat 10 was, even as big as The Witcher was, this is Batman.
Yeah.
Right? Arguably the most popular superhero in the world. This is also a franchise that has done incredibly well for them over the years. So here's the thing for me, right? A couple of years back when they released Arkham City, I don't know if you guys remember, they included the Catwoman DLC. It was basically single player.
Right.
And they made it was back during that whole Project $10 period.
Yeah.
And the Catwoman DLC was single player, basically single player DLC. It's the first time we'd ever seen anything like that, where it was put in the box and it was only there for new people that bought the game new. And they kind of slipped that in because for months and months and months, I think it was almost a year, they had been hyping up the fact that Catwoman was going to be in the game. And then when a couple of weeks before release, they came out and they said, yeah, it's going to be a DLC. It's going to be a code, and it's only going to be for new buyers. And a lot of people got upset about that. Now, I got upset about that because I felt like that was just another jab at people trying to take out used games. I still bought the game new. I bought it day one. And the voucher that I got for the Catwoman DLC was blank. It had no code on it. And this happened to a ton of people across the country where the vouchers were blank. And so Rocksteady, of course, went into damage control mode, and I had to contact Warner Brothers and go through this big ordeal on the phone, and it took them almost 2 weeks for them to mail me a code, okay? And I was a new buyer. In the meantime, in reaction to this, GameStop was still going to sell used copies of Arkham City. And the kicker was, with these used copies, they were including a voucher for the Catwoman DLC, which meant that they were buying the codes directly from Warner Brothers. So I would have been better off buying the game used, the whole thing that the industry has tried to, you know, push into everybody's heads for years, basically to where if I'm buying used, I'm a criminal. And they were basically in bed with GameStop at the time, even though they were saying we only want to promote, you know, used cars, new copies of this game, they still basically found a way to get a cut off of the used sales. And it just struck me as so hypocritical and just so tone deaf, you know? And you could see how tone deaf Warner Brothers was when they released that Game of the Year edition of Arkham City, where it had all that crap strapped on the box. It's like 10 of 10, and you could even see Batman's face.
Yeah.
But anyway.
They really wanted to make that the main point.
Yeah.
But this is just and we talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, where I had said that I felt like the Steam refunds were not – they weren't being done because Valve was being altruistic. It was because of people releasing broken games. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to me to have basically an example of that 2 weeks after this happened, because – Phil, I think you're absolutely right. I think that they would not be doing this if refunds were not a thing. They would go, you know what? We got your money. And just like every other game that's come out busted, we know you can't do anything about it. And we're going to kind of try and fix it along the way, but it'll never be optimal. But you know what? We don't care. We got your $60. And to have this happen on one of the biggest AAA titles of the year, I think personally is a little bit awesome. And the reason that I do is because, to your point, Phil, and to yours, Pat, especially think now bringing in the Mortal Kombat thing that I didn't know about, no one would have done this months ago if Steam stuff was in place. So, but for me, I think the funniest part about this is that this is basically happening sort of in a bubble, because this is really a console game manufacturer putting a PC port out and basically hoping that they could screw over the PC player base in the same way that they've been able to screw over the console player base. And they're not able to do that. And I'm really hoping at some point in the near future for digital stuff, we get some kind of refund policy in place for this, because game companies, frankly, have shown that they can't be trusted to actually put out a product that works. Not everyone, but some of them. Like, hell, I even feel that way with Blizzard right now. Like, I put down my money on Warlords of Draenor, and I pay my subscription fee every month. And I'm basically getting half of the level of content that I used to get, and they're charging more for it. So I'm really fascinated to see how this will play out. And I think that they knew it was broken, and they didn't care. But I don't think they really expected – I think Warner Brothers, when it comes particularly to Batman, I think they really overestimate how much crap people will take. Yeah. And with that refund policy in place, I would love to see what their return numbers were. I mean, it has to be almost close to 100% for them to just suspend the game.
Yeah,
well, like because I want because. Well, do we know if Steam taxes these guys for a return? Does Steam still keep a cut of the money anyway?
Oh, that would be hilarious.
Because that's what I'm wondering. Because that's what I'm thinking. This may end up making this whole thing a losing proposition.
If these are raw dollars coming out of WB's asshole, then that's going to make this a short discussion.
Yeah, I don't know if, I don't know if Steam refunds their cut of it as well.
Yeah. Well, because I would think that even if they do, simply because they had representation on the marketplace, that Steam would still charge something.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say that the reviews on Steam were so negative for Arkham Knight that it actually disappeared from the front page.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm gonna make that a thing that I'm gonna do this week. I'm gonna try and find out even with refunds, if Steam still takes a cut. Because if that's the case, honestly, that's the best thing that could happen. Because even if right now, even if somebody returns something, the companies like WB and stuff, they don't have that sale. But I don't know that it affects them in a negative financial way, especially if that sale can be made up. Yeah. But if this is the case where Steam, has their cut, and then even if the game is returned, they still keep something, then that firmly puts these companies in the negative. And if that's the case, that's really going to change how they do these things.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to seeing how this plays out now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm also looking forward to hopefully other developers taking this as a learning experience and not putting out crap PC ports anymore. I mean,
Well, and I think I just find it crazy, because again, going back to what they did with Arkham City, I remember sitting there going, "This is going to be the precedent." For a company, especially if that Project $10 kind of stuff really lasted, I remember thinking this is going to be the precedent for these companies to start locking out content behind paywalls to really stop the sale of used games. And it really, really concerned me. And the thing was is that, the way that a lot of these suits, the way these guys think is, you put that in Batman – a lot of people and gamers have shown, I think for the most part, that they're sort of willing to take it on the chin if they like a game.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there thinking there's probably some asshole in a boardroom who's like, "Well, look at how many copies we sold, and look, we projected this many we'd have to do used, and look at how many we sold new, and it's this increase, and we think it was because we stuck this DLC code in there because we basically stripped it out of the game and made sure that they bought it new in order to get this portion of it." And
I remember sitting glom glom.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember sitting there thinking, of course they could do this on Batman, a game that's going to sell and has that pedigree. They're not going to do that on Horse Adventures 4. but they could get away with it on a Batman game and people would be like, "You know what? I like this game. I want this game enough that I'll still deal with this." And I think that has sort of also that mentality has also led to the reason why we started to really get broken games being sold to us. We're basically buying into the beta. The Steam refund policy is the equalizer. So I can't wait to see the way the rest of this plays out. I don't want to see anything bad happen to a company like Rocksteady, but this purely seems like it was a WB Studios choice, and they've shown that they don't care. They've shown that they're shifty and shady. And so finally we have people that are able to speak with their wallet and ask for refunds, and maybe this might be the last time they pull this crap, because they're pulling it before, obviously, because they thought they could get away with it.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to watch.
A for consumer protections.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I suspect I wonder what the next big PC release is going to be this year.
I bet you Ubisoft is shaking right now.
Yeah, they have to absolutely get the PC version of Syndicate right, or they're pretty much kind of screwed.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And really everything else from now on. And, you know, I think that's the other thing that's really interesting about all this. I was talking to a buddy of mine last night about this, is that, you know, when you 10 years ago, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit on the show, 10 years ago, I would not have imagined sort of like this breadth of console games on PC. And I think it's sort of telling as well as how much outsourcing that this has done and how it's basically kind of treated like an afterthought. It kind of shows that these console companies feel like they have to put something out on PC, even if it doesn't become a priority. And with this portion, or with this policy now where it comes to refunds, they're obviously going to have to put some development dollars behind the PCs. And I wonder if that shift too might see us getting even more glitchy console games and having the PC games come out cleaner, simply because console gamers can't ask for a refund.
I hope not. I just hope it raises the quality of across the board.
I hope so too. But
because if you're going to put the effort into one version, you may as well do it on the others.
Right, but this was strictly motivated by money. Yeah. It has to be, right? Why have a 12-man team, you know, port a game that you've been working on for 4 years?
Yeah.
You know, why do that? Why have a 12-man team unless you were trying to cut corners?
Yeah.
So that's what makes me wonder, if they're dealing with a finite budget, if more of it goes to the PC development, does that also mean that we're going to see the same kind of thing on consoles? Are going to take away money from the console versions because they're still dealing with a limited budget? I don't know.
Only time's going to tell.
If you haven't noticed, I tend to just slant and towards the side that if they can screw us over, they will.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, you're right.
Welcome to my world.
Makes me appreciate like smaller studios and stuff even more these days, because they know they can't screw over their customers, because the minute they do, they don't have jobs.
Yeah. If you want
to. Yeah, I guess the moral of the story is, if any small developers are out there listening to this, keep doing you guys.
You're awesome.
Yeah. Except for the guys that repackage Unity assets and throw them on Steam. You guys suck.
Yeah, you guys are terrible people.
All right. Pat, you want to bring us on to this next story?
Yeah, so we talked about this on Let's Weekend, but I definitely want to revisit this with Lee here. DualShockers this past week brought us a great PS4 backward compatibility article talking about the differences between backward compatibility on from PS4 to PS3 and the difference between it from Xbox One to Xbox 360. And they really went into detail about the technical issues and the financial issues involved. They almost arrived at a solution, but they kind of whiffed on it at the very end of the article. So I just thought it was kind of interesting. And especially given, you know, and props to Shu Yoshida at E3 for not pulling a Don Matrick when he heard about Xbox One getting backward compatibility. He did say that it wasn't in the cards for the PS4, but he left open the possibility in the future, and seemed impressed that Microsoft was putting forth the effort, because in his own words, that must have taken a considerable amount of effort.
Can I put my cynical hat on?
Okay.
Yes. We're already halfway there anyway.
Well, when you're looking at backwards compatibility as far as PS3 games on PS4 goes, yeah, it's a lot of work. And it's something that, if you're the runner-up right now, it's in your best interest to do it.
Yeah.
Take that effort, you know, and make your clients happy, because you'll end up getting more clients. When you're already in a dominant market position, you don't have to put in as much work.
It's true.
See, I would take that. I would look at it a little bit differently. Well, I do absolutely agree with you. Sony's dominance in the marketplace I think is definitely a big part of the reason that, this might have not this might be something that's not particularly on their minds as something important. You know, when you talk to people about backwards compatibility, it's a really interesting conundrum because people seem to really feel that backwards compatibility is important, right? But when you look at it in a business sense, it sort of plays two different ways. So we live in a time period now where there are essentially a bunch of different ecosystems for products, right? Like if you are an Apple fan, you know, and you buy an iPad, you buy an iPhone and all that stuff, an Apple TV or anything else like that, chances are you're getting that content directly from Apple through iTunes. And so being in that ecosystem kind of keeps you the more and more devices that you get and the more and more interconnectivity that you get, the less likely you are to kind of stray from that system, right?
Right, yeah.
And I think that's why you have seen, particularly here over the last few years, like, you know, you have something like Steam, you have good old games, you have stuff like Green Man Gaming, you have Origin, you have Uplay, you have all of these companies basically kind of trying to create their own ecosystems to keep people in, right? And backwards compatibility can sort of work in that same way, but I have to wonder at times too, like when we're talking about this stuff, is that if companies like Sony and if companies like Microsoft really feel that that is something that adds value overall to their marketplace position, because unlike say Apple, who is like, again, you know, selling music on the iTunes store or anything else like that, older games are not system sellers, right? Like nobody's going to buy an Xbox One because it can play Xbox 360 games. That might be a thing that causes them to eventually make the switch over. But I don't know very many people that would list backwards compatibility as the reason that they bought a new system. Backwards compatibility is really, really important, I think, in the first year or two of a system's lifespan, because it gives people a reason to be early adopters while still giving them something to play. And I've always thought that it was really, really important because of that. Now, I think people like Sony disagree with me. And I think that their solution has been something like PS Now. They invested a lot of money into Gaikai. And PS Now is sort of – that is their backwards compatibility. I do not think that they will work on doing anything for backwards compatibility for the PlayStation 4 unless they start to lose. Then they can come back and they can go – all right, here's another feature that makes the PlayStation fantastic. And I think a big reason that they also have that feeling now is that look at the backlash that Microsoft got a few years ago when they announced the Xbox One. And remember how many features they announced for it that weren't really directly about gaming?
Yeah.
And they're firmly in second place. Now, even though backwards compatibility is about gaming, it's still sort of a feature bullet point that is not telling people you can play Gears of War 5, you can play Uncharted 7, you can do this or that. We have all this new stuff that you can do. It's, you know, those are the little things that let people feel better about the fact that they dropped $400 or $500 on a console. Sony, I think to your point, Phil, you know, Sony doesn't have to do it because they're not number one, and I don't think they're ever going to do it because their solution is Gaikai. And I got to be honest, I think that's a mistake, but they showed that they didn't care when they dropped backwards compatibility out of the PS3, and it really didn't do anything anyway. Yeah. You know, I know people got upset about it. Like, I'm personally upset about it simply because I had a PS3 fat that eventually died, and I still had plenty of PS2 games that I wasn't able to play. Because it seems like every generation I have a rolling backlog. I will actually now, I think I may be different than some people, but I will actually, you know, my kid is the one that plays the Xbox One a lot because of Minecraft. And I have a bunch of games that I never got around to playing on the 360 that even though I have a 360 sitting right below my Xbox One, for some reason, having the ability to play them on the Xbox One with the better controller, with arguably the better hardware as far as reliability, because I worry now, like with my Xbox One, like, when it, or with my Xbox 360, like, when is this thing going to die? You know, yeah. It's got all these moving parts. It's old. You know, the idea that I can now put these some of these games that I have that I want to play into my Xbox One and just play them, I think it's fantastic. But I also think it covers up the fact that up until this point, Microsoft really has not had a lot of pure system sellers. They don't really have a lot of exclusives. And I think that this is them sort of plugging the hole, so to speak, because like we just came back from E3. Yeah, they announced a lot of stuff, but even things that they announced last year, we didn't even see this year. Like, remember we saw the CGI opening of Crackdown? Crackdown was nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, they're so, for Gamescom.
Yeah, so I think this is one of those things where Microsoft also really pursued this because they have to. I think I'm not really sure how you guys feel, and I don't want to like sort of like drop a bomb in the room, but I think the Xbox 360 was the better console last generation, strictly because I think it met the expectations of the market, and they really trumped, I think, what Sony did, particularly in the online space.
Sony had that whole identity crisis thing going on, too.
Exactly.
They were trying to be Microsoft and kind of fell on their face.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, they didn't really work towards their strengths, which if you saw that with this generation, they sort of flipped it on its head. And that's kind of why they've come out on top, whereas Microsoft seemed to double down on the things that didn't matter, and that's why they're in second place.
Oh, speaking of, Omega Quintet out for $24 right now on the PSN flash sale. Get in on that. That's one of those Galapagos RPG titles I keep talking about. So,
okay. Yeah,
$24 but, still goes for 60 new. So
nice. Okay, yeah, I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I actually just bought the order on Amazon had it – or not Amazon. Best Buy had it for $20 because that's – you know, it's Bomba price. And I still hear it's, you know, it's a, you know, eight-hour game. I paid $20 for it. That's fine for me, but whatever.
It'll probably be an easy platinum too.
Exactly. So – and I want to see it too. I mean, from what I hear, like, you know, it got sold as one thing. Yeah, I heard it got sold as one thing. It kind of came as at another. But I had a $10 gift card too, so then it only cost me $10. So I'm not going to be mad even if it sucks.
Yeah.
So – but like back to the point, like I think Microsoft really kind of got with, I hate using the word like the zeitgeist of the time, but I think they were really able to tap into like, here's this cool stuff. Here's this everything that we have. You could play with your friends, and they had games that we hadn't really kind of seen before. Whereas Sony seemed to sort of be treading water in the last generation. And then I think that's really been flipped on its head this time. And the other thing about the backwards compatibility that I think is that part of me, and it's this, to put the cynical hat back on, part of me also thinks that a big reason that Sony also might not pursue it is that remakes make money. I think that last generation went on so long. I think that there were some games that got released, pretty much got released in states that they shouldn't have, where, you know, you had there was a certain level of jank involved in a lot of these games. Like a perfect example, in my opinion, is Darksiders 2. Darksiders 2 is a flawed game. It is still a good game. I don't know that I wanted a random loot system in what is supposed to be a Zelda clone. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. It was still a good game. But the big part of the problem that faced that game was technical limitations. It basically ran anywhere between 15 and 24 frames a second, no matter what you were doing. It was almost like it was too big for what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, now they've just announced that there's going to be the definitive edition of it coming out, I think, in October. And you know what? Probably going to buy it because I feel like I really want to see another Darksiders game. And this might be the only way to make that happen because of the, you know, how many times the IP has changed hands. So
it's almost like Kickstarter Lite too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so for me, like, on one hand, like, yeah, backwards compatibility would be cool. Like, I own Darksiders 2, but I'm going to buy the new version. Dishonored is the same way. That the definitive edition that they're pulling out, I really like Dishonored. I would probably still buy that. I have never beat Uncharted 2, and I've never started Uncharted 3. When the remakes come out, if they're decent, I'll buy those too. And I don't know if it's because, even though I have the games, it's because, you know, they'll run better and stuff like that. Like, that's a big part of it for me. I also wonder if psychologically it's me also justifying the purchase of these systems, you know? And I think Sony is kind of, frankly, is kind of banking on that. And I think some of these developers are too, because I know people that have worked on certain projects where they weren't happy with the way that things came out, and it was strictly because of the technical limitations. Yeah. So, you know, part of me feels like, particularly for this past generation that was split, I think, you know, there are a lot of people that didn't – there are either a lot of people that didn't own Xbox 360s, and there are a lot of people that didn't own PS3s. I have a lot of friends that did not own a PS3 at all, but now own a PS4, and something like the Uncharted trilogy remastered is right up their alley, because they've always wanted to play those games. They just never owned the system to play them on. Yeah. So I think for Sony being in the lead – they're not going to do the backwards compatibility because they don't have to, and because it opens up a new revenue stream to keep producing these kinds of remakes. And particularly for Sony, I mean, you have when you were looking at a company like they work with, like Naughty Dog, I mean, what are they? They're remastering God of War 3. They're remastering the Uncharted games. They remastered The Last of Us. Aren't they doing a Ratchet and Clank remaster as well? Like, yeah. This seems to be Sony's kind of bread and butter right now, where Microsoft seems to finally be going down that path with Gears of War, but that's really it. Yeah. So I think that's the other reason they won't do it, because it's a new monetary stream for them. Yeah. And this stuff is easy to – it's not hard to do. So it's an easy project that doesn't require a lot of people, and it can make them a considerable amount of money. Mm. And think about, again, to go back to that point, like, the people that didn't have a PS3 in the past, this lets them experience these games arguably in a better way than they were originally without having to buy the hardware. So that's why I don't think they'll ever do it.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
Yeah. I did kind of brush on one of the solutions that DualShockers presented, which was to allow gamers to put the disc in the PS4. And if that game is available on Gaikai, allow it to stream for free. Mm. Based on that as a possible solution.
Yeah. See, and I think that would be really cool. Like, I like the idea of PS Now. I mean, I've played it, but the problem for me, and we were talking about this before we started the show, is that for me, it's a bandwidth cap. Like, if you just gave me a three gig download of whatever this game was, and then I could play it at my leisure, that would be a reason why I'd subscribe to PS Now. But if I'm going to blow 5 or 10 gigs streaming this game for a day or two and not even be able to beat it, I mean, well, I have two other people in my house that use the internet. My wife streams video all the time. I work at home. My wife works at home. Like, so we're constantly kind of getting right up against that cap. And that's why PS Now right now is a non-starter for me.
Yeah.
If they could do Microsoft's model where I put in the disc and it downloads the version of the game with the emulator attached and everything, I'd be all over it. Yeah. But I don't know what it is. Like, maybe it's also partly because, you know, again, Sony's a Japanese company. I don't know what their internet situation is there, but maybe they don't have to deal with the caps and the reality of shitty internet in the way that America does.
Well, it's not just that. It's also the issue of the cell architecture being just so thoroughly weird.
Yeah, that was a very over-engineered piece of machinery.
Yeah.
I mean, it was gorgeous when people actually tapped into it properly, but it was really weird compared to, you know, literally everything else on the market.
Yeah.
And so going to make it a real bitch to emulate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that processor, if you've done some reading on it, that processor was designed to be antagonistic to developers. I'm not even kidding.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was that processor is sort of like is a prime example of Ken Kutaragi's hubris.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He was like, I'm going to make this and you are going to like it. And it's going to be so good that you're going to make things that work with it.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we all saw that ended up.
It is Ken Kutaragi in chip form.
Yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
So the things that the base facts that we went over on Let's Weekend, we just kind of touched on some of these reasons backward compatibility is difficult or contentious. The first one is costs of emulation development may outweigh the benefits of implementation. We've been talking about that.
Yeah. For Sony, pretty much this entire segment. That's clearly the case for Sony.
Yeah. Hmm. Also, legacy hardware still at retail. We haven't really talked about this. Still does need to be sold through to the consumer, which I think is something that doesn't get brought up a whole lot. But, you know, if you're going to a store, whether it's a dedicated gaming store or something more along the lines of a Walmart or a Target, you can still buy PS3s and Xbox Ones there, or Xbox 360s there.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's still a seller.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's still $250 too.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you add extensive backward compatibility right now, that's a lot of that hardware that's probably lost to the ether, if you will.
Yes. And sit around on store shelves.
Yeah, and until they clearance it out or something at a
right.
at a considerable loss. And so
and I can see that too, because what do you call it? It seems like every other few weeks there's some kind of sale on this hardware, and whether it's not like an actual sale where it's like get a PS3 for, you know, $350 or $300, they will turn around and throw in two or three games for that $400 price point. So I think the realities of the marketplace as well now is that it's probably a lot more difficult to sell this hardware, even though it's technically at a lower price point than last generation right now, simply because of the fact that there's not a lot of new software out for it that doesn't have the backwards compatibility and everything else like that. Yeah, so I can totally see that as Sony or them going, yeah, well, we could take a loss on this hardware we've already sold to these people, or just keep these SKUs completely separate and not let their two markets mingle.
Yeah. And if there's still a massive hardware at retail, then I do think that is pretty smart, because at least until they get a lot of it unloaded, it's going to – I mean, that would be the big elephant in the room.
Yeah. Well, that's the same. Sony's not really having trouble moving PS3s either.
Yeah.
They are selling through. But for how much longer?
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that too is that, like, you know, for the longest time, the PS4 was an inferior media machine. I still think it is, even though they've done upgrades now to the PS4. But the PS3 was a superior media machine, particularly as a Blu-ray player, compared to the PlayStation 4. So, like, while I'm not playing very much on my PS3 now, it still is regularly used in my house for Blu-rays. And if it died, I would buy another one of those over buying a standalone Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
Even though it might cost me an extra $100 simply because, you know, that hard drive and they could, even if, you know, a new format or anything, not a new format, but if new codecs or anything come out here in the future, Sony can just update that through firmware. So it's interesting to me that it feels to me like in a lot of ways the PS3 absolutely succeeded in being a multimedia machine in the way that Microsoft wants the Xbox One to be, and then failed in a lot of ways as a gaming console. And then basically Microsoft turned around and emulated the exact same thing this generation.
Yeah.
They learn, man.
Yeah. People learn.
By the same token, backward compatibility obviously matters because gamers' investments in entire generations do need protection. I don't know about it, everyone in here. I've got some 200 PS2 games that, you know, due to the lack of backward compatibility support going on right now, I have amassed a pile of PS2s just to protect my own investment so that, you know, if I have a system go out, I can just go to my closet and get another one and still play all these great games, because I do think the PS1 and PS2 combined for one of the best gaming libraries in the history of the industry. And so,
yeah, see, I have that problem, but I'm different in the sense that I don't have a lot of legacy hardware. So, like, even for me, even hooking up a PS2 to my big TV downstairs, becomes sort of like an exercise in futility because it looks terrible. At least with the PS3 that had backwards compatibility, there was an upscaler, so it kind of smoothed it out. So for me, my option is really just emulation, because I've got a really killer PC rig that's not going to have any trouble emulating anything on the PS2.
But
the other thing, though, for me is that's not ideal. I would still much rather play it with a regular PS2 controller. Of course, I can hook up a DualShock 3, but that's not really the point. I still would rather be playing this on my couch, you know, rather than up in my office, you know, and having to deal with compatibility patches and everything else like that. Like,
see, I do get out of the problem of it looking like asshole because I did get the PS2 component cables.
Well, see, and I have those too, but it doesn't. I have a 55-inch TV downstairs in my house, and at 55 inches, even with the component cables, it doesn't look very good.
Wow.
Yeah. I got the same problem.
Yeah. So for me, that's a big contributor as to why I haven't, why backwards compatibility is really, really important to me. And it's another reason why I like, going back to the bandwidth thing, it's why PS Now just doesn't work for me. Because I would love to play. God, I would love to. How many times you guys heard me harp on Dragon Quest? I would love to play Dragon Quest 8 on my PS3 or on my PS4. Even if it's not up-resed, even if it's not anything, like, I would still love to go back and revisit that game.
Yeah.
And I really can't, simply because of the hardware that I have, because of that generational shift, and with the HD-SD shift, it's not feasible. It's a much less enjoyable experience, and I have no real alternative on how I want to actually enjoy that besides the PC, which, by the way, Dragon Quest 8 emulated on PC looks like a cartoon. Like a moving, like a living Dragon Ball, or not Dragon Ball cartoon, a living Dragon Quest cartoon. It's really neat, but there's still something about it that's just not the same to me, and I can't put my finger on.
Yeah. So, the solution that I think they kind of brushed by, but ultimately whiffed on, was to keep backward compatibility a generation behind. You know, we don't really need our PS4s play PS3 games. We don't really need our Xbox Ones to play Xbox 360 games. We're glad they're starting to. What we need is for our PS4s to play PS2 and PS1 games, or the Xbox One to play legacy Xbox games.
That's actually a great idea.
Yeah. You know, if emulation is a problem with just a one generation back issue, especially with the cell that we talked about, don't bother doing that. Keep a scenario where you can still sell PS3s. I think that's great, honestly. But and by the same token, PS3 hardware is not going to just mass fail over the course of the PS4's lifespan. It is going to take longer than that for hardware failure on the scale that I'm talking about becoming a major issue. PS1s and PS2s, maybe not so much. So, Lee, you touched on this a minute ago with the emulation scenario. It also comes back to, you know, if Sony doesn't find a way to support those libraries, the community inevitably will. And so,
yeah.
You know, hopefully we can kind of use brute force emulation to go back a couple generations, a few generations, and keep these much older games playable while still supporting what's actually still on the market. Yeah. I don't think it's either or. I think you can have a situation, an ecosystem in place where all of this stuff thrives.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, especially with GameStop getting back into legacy product, you know, that ought to be a clue, right?
Yeah.
This whole thing can become a concise, coherent deal, really. And hopefully everyone catches on to what everyone else is doing and starts to try and foster that. Mm. Because I think it is what gaming needs to do moving forward as
we get
more and more invested in moving parts.
I completely agree. And I think the other thing that's really important about this is that, you know, for all the talks that the industry has and has had over the years about the fact that, you know, this the games are an art form, it doesn't seem to really be doing very much that you expect or that you see that other art forms do to actually preserve that art.
Yeah.
It's something that I feel has sort of kind of grossly been missing when we talk about mm-hmm. these kinds of things. And it is something that absolutely needs to be dealt with because...
And there are many entities that have been openly antagonistic to the idea that...
Yeah, exactly. So this is definitely one of those things that... And you know what the thing is to Pat, to your point as well about keeping this stuff from these legacy systems, someone like Microsoft might not have nearly as much skin in the game as someone like Sony or even to take it a step further, Nintendo. You know, Sony has four generations of systems that could really benefit from this. It's four generations of games and you know, that are sort of like the catalog from where we went to where we are now. Like, I read something just the other day that said, like, the amount of polygons in Batman's model in Arkham Knight is more than all the polygons they used to render all the environments in Arkham Asylum.
Wow.
Like, that's crazy, right? Like, that's that jump of progress when it comes to this stuff. But, could you imagine if you could even go back just something as simple as that and not play it anymore? Like, that's Sony and all these companies, you know, kind of have, I think, more so than a Microsoft. This could be a big thing for them. Like, you know, if they're going to sit here and talk about this stuff as art and everything else like that, then I really feel like they should make a move to make it more available than it is now.
Yeah.
And I think backwards compatibility, Pat, to your point, is the way to do it.
Yeah.
And you would think again, going back to like ecosystems and stuff like that, you would think particularly a company like Sony or even a company, particularly someone like Nintendo, you would think would be really invested in this. And just the idea of like, here are these games. And think about the revenue stream that could also create, you know, here are these old games and you still have ways to play them. So, you know, and with GameStop getting back into legacy products, you know, why couldn't some of these games, particularly ones that are rare, start getting reprinted,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you know, give these companies a cut because they're also, you know, setting up their architecture to where you can still play this stuff.
Yep. And for more on this, I just wanted to bring up about, you know, entities in the industry being openly antagonistic to this sort of thing. Episode 15. Just saying, putting that out there.
We talked a lot about that then.
Yes. So yeah, hopefully this is something that, you know, obviously the industry is still grappling with it, but hopefully they also continue giving it at least some attention and, you know, looking at it as something to be addressed over time, because it's not something that has to happen overnight. It would be a nice place for them to arrive to, at least by the end of this generation.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, it is possible too that could be something we could see that as a byproduct, simply because these newer consoles are all running x86 architecture.
Yeah.
You know, if the next consoles that come out are also x86, or you know, whatever platform that they're dealing with at that time, you know, if they're still keeping with the off-the-shelf components, being able to emulate those is going to be a lot easier than an over-engineered piece of hardware like the cell chip.
Yeah.
So that could be really good for this kind of thing as well.
By the same token, the PS5, by the time we get it, should have no problem brute forcing even the PS3 by the time we get it.
Yep.
But all the more reason to hopefully invest ourselves in a longer console life cycle like we had this past go around.
Yeah. So this next story, a little quick note. Apparently, according to Bethesda, they had a Doom 4 that was in the works, and they ended up scrapping it because it was kind of turning into Call of Doom.
That, to me, is a mercy.
That's great.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know if you were watching the Bethesda keynote this year, but what I saw of Doom this year was like amazing.
It's what they needed to make.
This is what I've wanted for, you know, 10 plus years now, ever since Doom 3 came out, and that was kind of a debacle.
And honestly, I think if my mom was still around, she loved Doom.
Yeah.
Like, I still remember she gave herself motion sickness playing it when we first got our, when we got our first, you know, PC.
Yeah.
And then it kind of gave her this tolerance to it moving forward, and she just got more addicted to Doom than I was. And she would have been all about what Bethesda showed to kick off E3. So I, yeah, this is definitely Doom in a very pure form, and it's really the game they needed to make.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a sign that, you know, sometimes you really got to look at what you got, and if it's not cutting it, you just cut it.
Yeah.
Well, not just that. You got to give them props, too. I think, you know, obviously this is Bethesda. You know, they're doing it. I think they caught some flack from a lot of people when they did Fallout 3. There were a whole bunch of fanboys that were like, Fallout 3 is not the Fallout that I know. Yeah. Now, I love Fallout 3, and I was a Fallout fan before. So I don't feel that way. But I got to give them props, too, to basically going, you know, what we were producing didn't feel like Doom. So we're going to gut it so we can make something that actually does feel like Doom.
Yeah.
I think particularly in light of what we've just been talking about, you know, at the beginning of the show, where these people don't seem to give a crap about their customers, the fact that they would do that to produce the kind of game that, that they there's probably a real thirst for, I think is commendable.
Yeah.
Not to mention it probably make them more money in the long run. They wouldn't have to deal with the fact that people would be like, this is a Doom.
Yeah. And people have already spent 10 years saying this isn't Doom about Doom 3, so I don't think they want to go through that again.
Yeah, the worst thing they could the worst thing they could do is make a game and have it come out as Doom 3.5.
Yeah, which is, if you look at the little the footage that they've got on the Polygon article, that's kind of what it was turning into. So, yeah,
mercy killing.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think there's really a whole heck of a lot to say about that. I just wanted to bring it up. What you might have something to say about, Lee, is Dragon Quest VI now coming to your phone.
Signs of life.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, I was disappointed at E3 this year that we didn't see anything about 7. I didn't figure we'd see anything about 8 simply because, you know,
they're gonna usually takes order.
Yeah, they're going to do them in order, but not just that. It usually takes them, you know, a year or so. Like, I remember when 9 got announced. 9 was out for a year before we were told it was coming to the stateside. So, or it was almost a year anyway. But, you know, I talked about it on the Let's Weekend about how disappointed I was with Square. Like, I felt like, you know, this is obviously a company that was trying to really reinvigorate itself and really get back to its roots and really do what made it successful, which, you know, I'm totally about. But I think that there's no doubt whatsoever that handhelds are obviously hurting from mobile. So I can't fault Square for also pushing stuff on the mobile platform. The problem is that I also feel like this should be more of an approach to where if you're going to be doing this kind of thing, you still should throw a bone to the people that have these handheld consoles. For a couple of reasons, I think it actually works in their favor as well. Square charges a pretty decent amount for their phone games.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still roughly about half of what they would get if they put it out on the 3DS.
And by the same, of course, at the same time, you get your money's worth, especially on the original content.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that is a plug for Final Fantasy Dimensions again. I'm not even going to hide it. But,
I mean, I get it. There's physical cost too for them producing like a 3DS card or something like that. But that's the other reason why you can get away with charging $40 or $50 for it.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that they put it out there. But the other problem I think with a lot of those as well, though, is to me having played them. Now, of course, I haven't played 6. On iOS, but they feel very compromised. So like on one hand, I'm torn because I'm sitting here, we're talking about trying to make some of these older games, still keeping them playable. At least this is a way to do it, but it's not in a format that I think is, it's in a format that I don't think represents what makes the games great.
Well, 6 is already available on DS.
Yeah. And you can get it on DS and that's fine. Like, so like in this sense, you know, okay. You know, fine. You put it out on iOS to make a little more money. Cool. At least you're not forgetting that Dragon Quest exists. But on the other hand,
I would also say that now iOS is caught up to mobile to handheld.
Exactly. And so that really makes me wonder is that if we do see a 7, frankly, if it's just going to come out on the iPhone. And if it's going to be like that, I don't really want to play it that way.
I can't say anything on that at this point. I still think we're going to get the 3DS versions of 7 and 8, but you know, I almost, you know, looking at what Square Enix did at E3, I almost wonder if they did a little bit of Microsoft-style punting down to Gamescom or Paris Game Show or something. And, you know, they just didn't want to overcrowd their show and get some games like Dragon Quest VII caught in the undertow of Final Fantasy VII Remake or Project Setsuna, things like that.
And see, you know what? I'm almost there with you, except for the fact that Dragon Quest is, at least in Japan, of course it's not that way in America.
E3 is becoming more and more of a Western centric.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know that. But
so maybe TGS, you know, maybe Gamescom, you know. Gamescom has become a really good, yeah, PAX has been a really good outlet for publishers to fill out their calendars with stuff that they just didn't have room for on E3. We talk about the cutting room floor a lot. It's not all in those days leading up to E3, even though a lot of it does happen there. You also learn a lot about what was held back at these subsequent shows. And so I think we got to get through this entire trade show season before we really have a good picture of whether or not everything's coming or not.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that if they're, you know, I do kind of hope it's sort of an inevitability, because if they do, they obviously have shown that they want to try and reinvigorate, you know, particularly their presence, you know, in America. But it's just always one of those things that's crazy to me, because, like, I know we're never going to get 10. Fine, whatever. I don't want an MMO anyway. MMOs, for the most part, are pretty much, you know, failing out of the box anyway. But, you know, and we do have Dragon Quest Heroes. But, again, that's sort of like, I feel like a half measure. So, yeah, I mean, we could see something at Gamescom and everything else like that. But the fact that, I mean, we saw – well, I don't know. I think, Pat, yeah, I mean – you're right. I mean, E3 is so much about kind of setting the stage for everything else that's coming after. They did announce that new studio and all these other things. Maybe they just felt like amongst those things, you know, oh, and by the way, we're, you know, Dragon Quest VII is coming out. That might not get as much pop, especially after you have like a Final Fantasy VII announcement or anything else like that. But it's just, it still feels bad to me as a fan and as a supporter.
Yeah.
To kind of feel like, oh, well, you know, because Dragon Quest is, in my eyes, and I think, too, for a lot of people, and especially in Japan, Dragon Quest is just as big a deal as Final Fantasy. So, yeah. And I think they're doing themselves a disservice for not treating them as such. And so, like, if you're like, well, we're not going to announce something like this, well, I don't know. Going back to what we were talking, it is just a port, right? It is just, yeah. Not a port. But Dragon Quest VII is a port. Dragon Quest VIII are ports. They're old games. Yeah. I guess thinking of, you know, saying
if
it out
was
loud,
Dragon Quest XI, we would have heard.
Yeah,
about it.
We would have seen it exactly. Yeah, that's kind of where I'm getting. So I don't know. Maybe Gamescom. I can only hope.
Yeah,
but I'm glad to see they're at least still releasing.
Sports analogy. So yeah. Get ready to cringe. think about it like E3 is like the finals of whatever sport you're watching. But right after that, you've still got the draft. You've still got free agency where a lot of things are going to happen. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of role that Gamescom and all these other shows have sort of taken on over the years.
Yeah, I'm getting the sense that these companies are kind of doing a lot more looking at who their audiences is and tailoring their shows to be more appropriate to those particular audiences.
Yeah.
You know, Dragon Quest didn't do all that great here, but it did do very well in Europe.
Yeah.
It makes sense to, you know, hold that for there.
Yeah, that basically shines a big laser light on Gamescom right there.
Yeah.
Right.
But no, there's not a doubt in my mind that we're going to get those games.
Hmm.
I just don't think that Square Enix wants to put them front and center at E3 when they've got so much else in the pipeline.
Well, and to be fair, everything that they also did announce at E3 was new. Even the Final Fantasy remake is new. Yeah. These are old, you know, these are just games that were old in the first place and are being ported, you know, to the 3DS. So I could see that as them using the jump off to go, this is our new stuff. This is the importance. This is the future. And then Dragon Quest, you know, 7 and 8 being done, you know, translated and being brought to North America are, you know, here's the other stuff we're doing. And, you know, because to be fair, it's not like we saw any other new mobile games. Like, they didn't come out and go, Record Keeper 2 is coming or something. Yeah. So, yeah. I could see
I that. Wish Record Keeper 2 was coming because I have a lot of ideas for what they could do with it.
Yeah.
But that's just me being me.
Yeah.
But, no, on the mobile side, I'm disappointed that we didn't get a North American announcement for stuff like Mobius Final Fantasy or Dimensions 2, you know, stuff that we know is a thing, but, you know, we still need those announcements.
Yeah. Well, there's still three more shows left this year, so we got plenty of time.
Yep.
What is left? Gamescom?
Paris Games Show and TGS.
TGS, yeah.
TGS is going to be fantastic.
Yeah. And then they already did PAX East, right?
Yeah, I think that already happened.
I'm still not entirely clear on when the PAX schedule works. Yeah. I know there's like three or four of them by now.
Yeah.
PAX Prime, PAX South,
PAX East.
PAX East. And I don't know, maybe one of those is still on the calendar.
I think there's also a PAX Australia. But I don't know. So there's that. Anyway.
Well, we already know Project Cars 2 is happening, so that's probably where we'd see the first footage of that.
Yeah.
Keiji Inafune making it known publicly that he still wants to make Mega Man Legends 3. It's a good sentiment. I'm not sure how much water it really holds unless he and Jun Takeuchi are ready to bury the hatchet.
Yeah, there's a lot that needs to happen for that, you know, for that arrangement to manifest itself. But, you know, it's 2015, you know, people change.
Yeah.
The other part about that that's so funny to me is just that, you know, again, like you have these companies that were just being like, yeah, you know, what you want to make won't work anymore. And then now we have Inafune with a successful Kickstarter. We have the I can't think of his name.
Igarashi,
yeah, has got his Kickstarter with Castlevania.
Yu Suzuki,
yeah, sort of with you know Shenmue. You know, you have these creators where all these companies were like, yeah, this is not feasible. We don't want to make these games, and they're like, well, we're going to make them anyway. And then now I think it's going to be interesting in the next few years to sort of see the snapback, particularly if these things turn out to be really, really successful for companies like Capcom, you know, to essentially give pause and go, maybe we've been doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I don't know how – I don't know Jun Takeuchi really well as an executive. I don't know how stubborn he is. I do know that when Inafune left Capcom and left the door open to still work with them at the time, I think it was Takeuchi who said, no, that won't be necessary. But, you know, who knows? It's just kind of interesting that Inafune is putting that out there now of all times with Mighty No. 9 all but finished. And, you know, I mean, obviously he's still busy with ReCore, but this isn't somebody who's all that scared of taking on multiple projects at a time.
No. I really find it fascinating to see. I kind of see this as an example of the industry correcting itself.
Yeah, this is a fun process to watch, no matter how it really ends up going. Things will end up the way they should be, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Do we know how it should be yet altogether? Maybe not. But that's part of what makes it so interesting as well.
Yeah, it's an ever-evolving process, and, you know, we're along for the ride here.
Yep.
So, speaking of successful Kickstarters.
But it's good news for people who... Yeah, it's good news for people who, on a basic level, want to see Legends 3 happen. Hmm. So, it's looking more hopeful for them now than it was, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So there is that.
Yeah. So yeah, Yu Suzuki is kind of posted an update on his Kickstarter and clarified the funding situation here. I still think it's kind of sketchy, but whatever. Basically, what he's saying it boils down to is Sony and Shibuya Studios are handling production assistance and marketing. Now, production assistance is a very vague term.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Production assistance is why Street Fighter V will never be on Xbox One.
Right.
But,
and it's hard to see examples of things like Street Fighter V and then to turn around and go, yeah, but that counted there, but it doesn't apply here.
Yeah.
So, and then like for me, my biggest issue just came back to adding.
Especially if we're to assume that this is Sony's MO moving forward, which is a good MO. I'm not hating on that. But I don't know. By the same token, I think if it was an exclusive, Yu Suzuki would come out and say it's exclusive. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they haven't announced any other platforms other than PS4 and Steam. So
yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's just.
I just don't think he'd be leaving the door open like this.
Yeah, and it may just be a part of it where they negotiated it where maybe Sony has first rights and then something comes after. Yeah.
That has been.
Let's not forget Sony owned a chunk of Square Enix, and that didn't stop Square Enix from putting out stuff on the Game Boy.
Yeah.
You know, so part of me wonders if like the difference as far as funding is that. Yeah, Sony is definitely probably chipping in some money to this, and maybe in the same way that exclusivity gets purchased, you know, with some games, maybe that gives them a window. Because maybe Yu Suzuki also came to the table and said, I need to put this in front of as many people as I possibly can to make the money that we need to make
to make this successful.
Yeah, but, that was, that but just was think about
genuine
it.
Genuine,
you know?
E3 moment.
Yeah, but just think about that, though. Maybe it could be, you know, they get Shenmue for a year. In the same way that we keep hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong if it's been clarified, but Rise of the Tomb Raider we know is coming first on the Xbox, yeah. But it's still going to show up on there. PS4.
Yes.
Right, but they're being vague months. About it. Yeah, so yeah, so maybe it could be the same kind of thing. And hell, even Square did that with Final Fantasy VII, with the remake. It was, you know, first on PlayStation.
Yeah.
So...
So I just think, you know, it is what it is, and yeah, I'm not as cynical about it as some might be, but that's just you look at the situation before E3. Shenmue 3 was never going to happen. It was a pipe dream. It was something that a small pocket of fanboys kind of held on hope to that. You know, maybe someday, hopefully, possibly, it could happen. Now we know. You put money in, Shenmue 3 comes out. And I don't know. Going back before E3, I think a lot of people who love this series would have jumped at the chance to just have that simple opportunity. So,
yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot going on with it.
Yeah. For me, it's seeing the situation on how it's kind of played out. For me, I didn't feel comfortable backing Shenmue 3. I just didn't because, you know, there's questions to be asked there, but when the game comes out, am I going to buy it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know,
cause you remember what Shenmue 1 and 2 did to both of us.
Yeah. Because at that point, you know, it's out, and, you know, it's all water under the bridge. Yeah. The game is produced.
And we talked about this on the, on Let's Weekend, I believe it was, or maybe it was last week's show. I was writing the review of the first game for Game Addicts Network, and I was extremely difficult to get a hold of all that week that I was just trying to plow through the game.
Yeah.
I mean, people were sending me IMs on, you know, obviously it was the year 2000. I was using ICQ. I would just play a bunch of Shenmue, run to the bathroom or some shit like that, and come back out, and I'd have like a wall of six people trying to get a hold of me. It's like, oh, how long was I playing?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I haven't kicked into Shenmue 3 yet, not because of financial questions, but just because the option that I was wanting to see wasn't there yet. It sound Yu Suzuki himself is hinting that the option I wanted, a physical PS4 copy, is probably going to be added sooner rather than later, and that's when I'm going to jump in.
Hmm. Yeah, so, we'll see.
If I can get in for $60 now and help make it a better game, then you know those stretch goals are pretty extensive, and I don't think there's any way in hell all of them are getting met now.
Yeah.
But you know, I want to do what I can to get as many of them met as possible. And if they're dangling a PS4 copy, you know, a physical copy, then I'd get in on that. Mm-hmm. And you know, better to be able to just buy it now and not have to worry about it than you know, have to worry about it later. And
yeah.
It's one of those things. It's like found money. Oh yeah, I did buy this already. Cool.
Yeah, assuming you actually end up getting it, because you know the world could explode and Shenmue 3 doesn't get made.
Well, then I'll be too dead to care.
Yeah.
So
there's that. Moving on, I did get a little bit of good news coming out of E3 in the regards of Star 2, Star Fox Zero.
So yes.
Nintendo is confirming that you will be able to turn the gyro controls off, and that's pretty much about all they said. They didn't mention Pro Controller. They didn't mention how it was going to work with the gyro controls off.
Yeah, but I think the message is pretty clear, though.
Yeah, it's like, okay, nobody liked the way this was playing out. We kind of got to do something about that.
Yeah, I'm sure for about 3 days there, Sad Miyamoto was sad. But then he went back to the drawing board and just fixed everything. And, you know, by the time we get the game, it'll be just fine.
Yeah.
I have no doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I talked to somebody who actually played it. And he said the only way that you could actually play it properly with the gyro controls is if you're standing up with the Wii gamepad directly in front of you. That's the only way you
That's not going to fly.
No. That's the only way that you could focus on two screens at once.
So it was a DS game.
Yeah, it was kind of a DS game with a really broken form factor. It was kind of doomed to fail.
I am so glad they made it open to testing at E3, because just to think that it could have gotten out into the wild like this, is cringeworthy.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they're listening, and well, given that they're number 3 in the market right now, they kind of have to.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they think of it that way. I think they just I think they look at it as they're getting spanked by the Wii. And, you know, Nintendo seems to not compare themselves to the rest of the market so much as they compare themselves to past performances. And, you know, they got to do something. I've beaten this into the ground. The Wii U is a fantastic system, but not enough people know it or even know about it to really give it that support.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, they have probably the best holiday lineup they've ever had this year. Hopefully they can start turning that around and maybe get some more people in the late running. And I think another price cut before the holidays would go a long way.
Yeah. A price cut and maybe a Star Fox bundle. That would get me in.
Oh, can you imagine what a Star Fox themed Wii U would look like? Have the cockpit motif on the controller.
Yeah.
That would look pretty cool.
Yeah. Lee, anything to add to that?
Not really. I'm kind of just past Nintendo in a lot of ways. I don't want to sit around and get pissed off about the fact that they usually don't listen, and I don't want to get pissed off about the fact that they they're just Nintendo's gonna Nintendo. Yep. And
Nintendo's gonna Nintendo.
You know. Yeah, so I'm just kinda like, all right,
when there's our episode title, I'm putting it in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, I'm not all that excited, I guess, about Star Fox. I guess I'm kind of taking a wait and see approach. But I'm kind of doing that with everything. I don't know what it's been like for you guys, but like for me, with particularly with the Wii U, like I go in and I play some of these games and I know they're fantastic and I know that they're fun and I know that they're well made, but there's still something for me that's lacking. I don't know if it's because I've played Nintendo style games for so long and that I want something a little bit different. Like Mario 3D World, I probably would have been more blown away by if I hadn't played Mario 3D Land 6 months beforehand. So
see, I was all up in that because that was the game that I wished Mario 64 and its ilk had been.
See, I loved Mario 64, and Mario 3D Land felt like the next step of that. But I guess the other part of it is that, you know, like coming from like playing Mario games where I played like, I don't know, four new Super Mario Brothers games that kind of all feel the same. And then to go from Mario 3D Land to playing Mario 3D World, it was just felt like, oh, well, it's prettier.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm kind of indifferent on a lot of Nintendo stuff currently, but I'm sure I'll get Star Fox when it comes out. I just, you know, I don't know.
I'm hoping Link Between the Worlds gets the same treatment, gets its turn on the TV.
Yeah.
That's like the one thing that that I would do as if I were in power at Nintendo that they haven't done yet.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Nintendo, and rather appropriate for this week, the way things have turned out, marriage equality confirmed for Fire Emblem Fates.
Sure. Yeah, this was kind of happened before the decision came down. So
yeah, by days. I mean, the timing couldn't have been better.
Yeah,
I actually think Kotaku actually did. They put up an article that was like, the United States follows Fire Emblem or something and legalizes gay marriage.
Yeah.
This was a feature that was kind of requested from Fire Emblem Awakening, but not as hugely so as you might think based on how that feature was really implemented in that game. I think this can actually be traced back a little further, well, not further, a little more recently, to Tomodachi Life and the fact that that it didn't have marriage equality in a game that was of the style that it was, and Fire Emblem Fates is giving them the chance to really fix that. And it's kind of interesting to see how it works because the whole reason you had the marriage mechanic in Awakening was because you would, in the second half of the game, the characters that you married off to each other would have their offspring show up as playable characters. Apparently, if you go the same sex route with some characters, it'll instead manifest itself as statistical boosts. And so that's an interesting way of working around that. One thing that they touched on was that I don't know exactly how this is going to work yet, which version will be which, but male pairings will be exclusive to one of the countries, Hoshido or Nor, and female pairings to the other. And the third country allows for both. And along with that announcement, we did get confirmation, unfortunately, that that two-version format from Japan is going to be a thing that happens over here in North America. So
that means Pat is buying the game twice.
Yeah, and the DLC.
Twice.
I can't help it. I love my Fire Emblem.
You're not the only one.
And I'm sure.
I can't wait for the amiibos to come out for it that I won't be able to buy.
Yeah, I'm not sure how amiibo would work in Fire Emblem unless you used like the Fire Emblem characters that are out right now to drop them in game, kind of like the DLC in Awakening. I also think it's set in stone now that certain shippers in the community will undoubtedly refer to the two versions of Fire Emblem Fates as the Yaoi version and Yuri version, considering how this all is playing out with each pairings being exclusive to Hoshido or Nor. But other than that, it's going to make for a more complete game, I think. And, you know, good on Nintendo.
Good on Nintendo. Although I think they kind of missed a trick. They could have really gone a bit deeper if they were going to, since they're going to allow the same-sex marriages, they could have actually accounted for surrogate parents for, you know, to make offspring.
That's true,
possible.
Too.
But, hey, they didn't ask me.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how this is going to work, but, you know, I am unfortunately not on the design team. That would be a good job.
Yeah. It's just nice that, you know, these kind of things are starting to happen now and we're not.
That's progress.
Yeah. So. We're not getting stuck in such a conservative, you know, type of mindset as far as sexual pairings goes.
And on the issue of Tomodachi Life, even Nintendo said, they kind of waffled on it at first. They said they weren't trying to be trailblazers or anything, and they weren't trying to make a political statement. But the fact that it's a feature that the fans wanted in the game was what brought it to their attention. So, you can take that however many ways you want to take it, but it's happening. Yep. And so,
and you'll be able to play it next year.
Yep. I envy Japan right now. I really do. Cause I need more Fire Emblem sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
I think there was another game from like 2010, 2011 that they could localize in the meantime, but I doubt that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Just give us something in the interim. We got a show?
I think we have a show. All right. Well, with that, I'm Filippo D'Anolfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Lee Lamb.
See you next week.